All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pint. I'm Jonathan Taylor, along with
Sean McCool.
John, we've got a legend joining us here shortly in the copywriting direct response industry. So I'm excited. You kind of set this up, so I'm going to have to let you take the lead here.
Yeah, and I think if you are not an actual copywriter, you just kind of study copy a little bit, you may not have heard of this guy. Because he hasn't really ever put a lot out there as far as courses or things like that, although he is putting a course together, thank goodness. So it's a little bit different. It's may not be a name you're familiar with. If you are familiar with it, then you know exactly how big of a deal it is to have him on.
Started out with Ogilvy and Mather.
So yeah.
Not a bad place to start, right?
Yeah, he's written for Fortune 500 companies.
Yeah,
you know, worked at Ogilvy and Mather. So yeah, I got his whole bio pulled up here. So, but before he comes on, let's talk some beverages.
Yes, I got a good one today.
All right,
a good one from our friends at Left Hand.
All right, Left Hand Brewing.
That's right. So I've got a peanut butter milk stout.
I like those.
So I can't remember if I've had this one on. The can doesn't seem familiar. So I don't think
recognize the can.
And I would know this copy if I had it before. So I pulled it up, and they've got some really good stuff. It says, the peanut butter milk stout, rich chocolate notes team up with peanut buttery perfection for a delicious dark duo. So they got the old Batman. So it goes rhythm and blues, Batman and Robin, peanut butter and chocolate. These classic duos never go out of style. So
correct.
It says enter peanut butter milk stout. We took the pure milk chocolate bliss of our classic milk stout and added peanut buttery goodness. It's like an adult peanut butter cup that you could drink. Ooh, man, that sounds good.
I think the first peanut butter stout, when I was first getting into craft beers, the first one I ever had was called Sweet Baby Jesus.
Ooh, yeah. I remember that. Yep.
Yeah. And I think I went up and brought some back one time. Mm-hmm. So that was my first like dive into this whole world, and look where we are now.
So. this stuff you see it everywhere now. I mean, everybody's jumping on the peanut butter craze.
Well, so what was your ABV there?
Oh, so it is, 25 IBUs. And 6.2% ABV.
All right. So I've got a working weekend from 903 Brewers.
Ooh, yum.
So this guy's smashing his computer. He's ready for I guess it's working for the weekend, actually, is what it says. Working for the weekend. Big difference, I guess. So this copy, this is from the same company I had last week, right? So this is a breakfast coffee stout with maple and blueberry.
Mm.
So it's like a full breakfast there, right?
Wow.
The French toast I had from them was a little too strong, so we'll see how this one does. But it says, after a busy work week, it's time to unwind with our working for the weekend stout. This hearty breakfast stout is loaded with coffee, maple, and blueberry, bold coffee beans. Bold coffee beans add. They do this reverse type. I cannot read it. Anyway.
It's like, a lot of tiny words there on that.
I totally get, like, I remember Clayton Makepeace saying one time at a seminar I went to probably 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And he was like, y'all need to stop putting such small font on reverse type, you know, backgrounds. And I'm like, what? I don't know what he's talking about. And like, I'm now again.
Now you know. Yeah.
Now I know.
Now you're at that age demographic. We both are.
So now I tell my junior copywriters, I'm like, hey, if you're selling to somebody that's over 45, up the font size.
Absolutely.
Cleaner backgrounds. I feel so old now.
By the way, I noticed you don't have your thin specs on.
Yeah, these are more like my regular computer glasses. So. Okay. Gotcha. I don't think they're as crisp as the other ones. Right. So maybe that was the problem. So is David there yet? I don't want to.
He is in the green room waiting.
Okay. I'm going to say this real quick. So my daughter, you know, she does YouTube and stuff, right?
Yeah.
So these people, Javi Coffee Concentrate, sent her this. Have you heard of this?
No.
So it's literally, you can make coffee with just a teaspoon of that. You make a cup of coffee with a teaspoon of this in either cold or hot water. So it depends if you want cold brew, hot brew, whatever. You just pour it in.
Wow.
So what I've done.
Have you tried it?
Not yet. So okay. As an experiment, though, I've done one teaspoon in the bottom of the glass. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to taste the coffee stout from the can without it. And then I'm going to pour it in the glass with the extra coffee and see if it, in case it's too sweet. Because, you know, these are one of those that could end up a little sweet.
Sure.
So while I'm testing, go ahead. And I guess, does David have something to drink? Can you tell in the green room? I can't see the green room this week.
Oh, you can't. Okay. He has looks like a coffee thermos cup. Perfect. He's holding up. So there's something in there. I know that much. There is some kind of liquid. Shooting. How you doing, David?
Hey, I'm great. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here on a Friday afternoon like this.
Yeah.
We got to give you some applause. Yeah.
We pull out all the stops, live audience, the whole bit.
It's like being on the Howard Stern show, you know, with all the little buttons.
Oh, yeah.
Make sounds.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We've got a whole bunch of unique sounds on this board.
Yep.
Well, thanks for coming on. I know it was kind of short notice, but we appreciate you coming on today and spending some time with us. We're going to have fun. We love talking about this, and we do this every Friday over a pint. I noticed you are holding up a coffee cup with something.
Right. In there. This looks more like a pint, I guess.
Oh, okay. There you go. There you go. That is a LaCroix. What flavor is that?
I think it's watermelon.
Ooh.
Peach pear.
There you go.
Sounds refreshing. On a hot day.
Those are pretty good. I like those LaCroix. We've had LaCroix on before. That's been a beverage before, I do believe. So.
Absolutely.
I hope you got a product placement.
That would be nice, but no, we're not quite there yet. We're getting there.
I'm amazed the way some people monetize their podcasts.
Yes.
And they sold every, you know, so often and all sorts of stuff going on.
Yeah. We don't have any commercials right now. We had a sponsor and do some affiliate stuff, but you know, for the most part, we're just writing off beer on our taxes is what we're actually doing.
There you go.
I don't think I'd want to have to worry about selling advertising on a podcast in addition to creating the podcast itself and doing all that.
Well, Jonathan does that on two or three other shows that he runs.
Yeah.
So the very small niches, you would love that, David. Yeah. It's like some really cool little obscure niches that hardly any competition in.
We've intersected before, haven't we, Jonathan?
Boy, it seems your name is so familiar when Sean sent it over. So I don't know. Seems like maybe I have had you on a past podcast. I've done about 1,000 podcast episodes over my lifetime. So it's I'd have to dig into the archives.
Okay. Well, so, I've learned about you, David, through AWAI, of course, and then Brian Kurtz and that whole Clayton Makepeace, that whole crowd. So been following you for a while. I think we met briefly once or twice, probably at an AWAI event.
We did. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a hard name to forget.
Yeah. I think we may have even sat at this same table one night for dinner or something like that.
I think we did. I think we did.
It was you and Richard Armstrong. And our better halves. Yeah. So,
maybe we should introduce, we haven't even mentioned his name to our audience yet.
Yeah, we will. Well, cause not everybody's watching. So
are we live? Is this being recorded? No, I'm kidding. I know it
is. Yeah.
No, it's Memorex.
We are live on, on tape. Yeah, we're live on tape, but, we're on live. We live stream YouTube and Facebook. But then we pull the audio and actually upload that edited to the podcast. So,
I see. I always get confused by that. That's right. It's live on Facebook and then it's while it's being kind of recorded.
Okay. Plus Jonathan has a recorder on his desk that, you know, the old tape recorder, press two fingers to record. Oh. Is that what you're using?
So like my sister is like surfing.
I've got a stack of Memorex.
Yeah, so Yeah, so maybe she'll run across it. But if not, we'll send you a link next week for the podcast, and you'll be able to share it with her, and she'll be spellbound.
Okay.
Okay. I'll drop a Memorex tape in the mail to you and send it to you, David.
Well, let's let me read David. I'm going to read your bio real quick. That was in your download from your website. Is that current enough for you? Does that work? Your free book.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what it says.
It's close enough, right?
Close enough. Okay.
All right. And you can correct anything if you want to, you know, say anything bigger or better. We'll let you do that too. We're all about
multiply everything by a factor of 1.5 or so, and I think we'll
probably hit it. All right.
Yeah, should hit it.
So this is David Deutsch. David is one of the top direct response marketing consultants and copywriters in the country, and author of Think Inside the Box, a book that reveals a revolutionary new way to generate ideas. His writing has sold hundreds of millions, so $150 million or hundreds of fifties of millions, trying to do 1.5 math on the fly, worth of his clients' products.
I actually added it up a few months ago because I was launching a product, and it's actually a billion.
There you go.
Everything I've done over the years and, you know, in advertising and everything.
So $1 billion worth of his clients' products, which include everything from books, seminars, and newsletters to Maxwell House Coffee and American Express cards. David started his advertising career at renowned Ogilvy & Mather advertising agency on Madison Avenue, and has the unique distinction of having been a creative director at both traditional ad agency as well as direct response agency. He's worked for all types of companies, from Fortune 500 companies such as Merrill Lynch, General Foods, and American Express, some of the top colleges and universities in the country, and many small businesses. Today, David writes for and consults mainly with companies and entrepreneurs who sell information and advice in print, online, through seminars, including Boardroom Inc., Rodale, Healthy Directions, Lifebook, and I'm sure a whole lot more at this point. So, David, welcome to the show again.
Well, thanks,
John. You get a double applause.
Double applause. All right.
So we need to, we were in the middle of discussing our beverages. You can share your LaCroix, but we typically give our beverages a rating, David, and we go 1 to 5 pints, persuasion by the pint, 5 being the best. So Sean, we'll start with you.
This is really good right out of the can. So it definitely has a little sweetness. You can taste the blueberry, which is kind of a different taste. And the maple's not too strong, which is nice. It is 12.6. So Jonathan, you may have to take over on this episode. 12.6 ABV. So I would give this a 4.75. It's right up there. It's really
4.75. Wow.
Yeah.
That's two 12s in a row each week. I mean, 2 weeks in a row, you've had pretty high.
This brand obviously likes to make their stuff strong.
Absolutely.
Because it's the same brewer. Now I'm going to pour it in my coffee and see what happens.
All right, David, while he's pouring his shot of coffee there, why don't you tell us a little bit about, is this a LaCroix that you typically have on? Is this a go-to? What did you say? Peach and what else?
Peach and pear.
Peach and pear. Those are very
alliterative.
Of course. That actually sounds really good during the summer. So does that have a pretty solid rating?
Oh, yeah.
So 1 to 5, what do you give it?
1 to 5. It is, after all, water with bubbles and a little
fizzy
flavor.
Water. Yep.
So I don't know if I could get too close to 5 on it, but I would give it a solid 4.5.
4.5. Okay. That's good.
Yeah. If it's your go-to, it's your go-to. No rules here.
Do you drink wine or beer or anything like that? Or do you kind of?
I'll drink wine sometimes, and sometimes I'll drink vodka.
Oh, okay. All right.
Like on the rocks.
What's your go-to vodka?
Tito's, Grey Goose.
Tito's, very good.
Totally black when I can find it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Very cool. You ever mix the LaCroix and the vodka? Seems like it might be a decent combination.
It does, actually.
I don't generally like diluting things for some reason.
Yeah. I like that.
The ice kind of dilutes it.
Yeah. I'm a neat bourbon guy myself, so I like just the pureness of it. So, well, all right, well, let's jump into some persuasion talk, copy talk. And so the way we usually go, Dave, is we don't actually have like a set of questions or anything like this. It's really three guys sitting around on Friday afternoon having a drink and talking shop. But we would like to know a little bit about your background. We have a lot of people who follow copy and persuasion and sales and marketing and that kind of stuff, but they may not know your name because you've, you know, you've kind of stayed, you're not as out there as a lot of the copywriters. You're too busy out there cashing the checks and writing $1 billion worth of copy. But tell us about how you made that transit, how you got into advertising in the first place, and then how you made the transition from Madison Avenue into direct response.
Well, I kind of fell into advertising in the beginning. I was working at Ogilvy & Mather in an administrative capacity out of college after having been teaching. And while I was there, I kind of became interested in it and thought, hey, I can write. I'm clever. I wonder if I could do this. And, you know, Ogilvy was a great agency in a way because it's kind of like a teaching hospital. You know, they're always teaching. There's all these, you know, the word according to Ogilvy and all this stuff. And I was lucky enough to break into copywriting there and just get wonderful training because, you know, Ogilvy preparing me for my later move into direct response, because Ogilvy was very much a direct response kind of guy in a way, very accountable oriented. He called direct mail his first love and secret weapon. And, you know, he made people read people like Caples and Hopkins. So these were people that were familiar with me long before I even got into direct response.
Hmm. Was that pretty rare on Madison Avenue at that time? Or was there a handful of companies, you know, that had that direct response kind of leaning?
There were a handful. But yeah, it was pretty rare, especially in those days. I think when I checked Hopkins out of the library, I think the last person that checked it out was probably Gary Benzavenga. You know, I mean, it was so, such a long time ago.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem like that book had gotten, you know, a lot of use.
Right.
Actually, now that I think about it, I think Gary worked across the street at BBDO in their direct response division there. But yeah, that was pretty, it was very lucky to have that ingrained in me at such an early age, as it were. Then I bounced around advertising agencies for a while, discovered J. Abraham, and went, wow, I really like this. This is, you know, this kind of thinking. And so I left the ad world and got into the direct response world and did writing there and eventually fell in with, you know, Boardroom and the big publishers, got controls for them. And, you know, these days I do more consulting, training, teaching, coaching, helping people write better copy than I do writing it myself. I really enjoy helping people write better copy and solving copy problems and showing people, you know, I call it copy thinking. Mm-hmm. It seems like so much of copywriting is really thinking. And not really writing. It's solving that problem. It's how do you get into that conversation with the reader? How do you position the product, you know, in a new and interesting way?
Yeah, I think that's, I love that you made your own term for it too, as a true copywriter would, right? You could come up with copy thinking. I agree. I wrote an article early on for AWAI when I kind of got into the business with them. Mm-hmm. And it was about the anti-writing secret of six-figure copywriters. And it was reading. It wasn't thinking, but it was, you know, same lines. It's like you have to gather so much information and think about things so much before you can ever write something decent.
And I love that part of it. I really love
the research side. You enjoy digging in,
talking to people, finding out stuff.
Yeah.
Thinking about stuff. A lot of times clients ask me, you know, is the copy done yet? I'll say, yep, everything but the words. But to me, that's
90%,
right? You know, that's, yeah, it's like, yeah. You have to put some words on the page now. Yeah. I kind of know what I'm going to say.
So what does that process look like? I'm curious, David, like, you know, Gary Halbert's talked about, he sits, you know, 3 or 4 days, he's kind of sitting around, go out on his boat, you know, and then all of a sudden gets the idea and comes back and pounds it out, at least the first draft. What does that process look like for you start to finish with a, from the time you get an assignment, like thinking time versus writing time?
Well, more and more, I kind of do both, right? Because I find that if I'm not writing while I'm thinking and researching, that the writing helps point me to what I need to research and think about. Yeah. So I'll start writing headlines right away. I'll start trying to put something on the page right away, and then I'll see where I get stuck, or I'll see where I have questions about it. Mm. Like, oh, I wonder if I should take this approach or this approach, right? Then I'll go out and research and talk to people, and I'll try talking to them from this approach and this approach and say, oh, look at that, the approach on the right, people are interested in that. When I talk about the approach on the left, their eyes glaze over.
Right. So you sit down, you open up a doc, you start writing.
Headlines, openings, how would I start this?
And are you looking for like that kind of gut feel that's like, ooh, that's pretty good? How does that unfold as you just, let's say with the kind of the headline and maybe the subhead, or does it just feel like there's something blank there and you're like, oh, what I need here is a statistic, or what I need here is a story, or kind of how does that?
Yeah. It tends to be more like you first said. It's like, does this resonate? Like in music, yeah. Right? You play a note, you go, oh, that's so off key, right? Then you play, you hear something, people play together, you go, oh, that sounds beautiful together. That works, right?
Yeah.
So a little bit like that. And then afterwards it'll be, oh, maybe let me try opening with a story instead. Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing for me as a writer, and I think for other writers as well, because it's something I kind of have to coach people out of, it's getting trapped in a kind of a writing frame of mind. Like, here I am, I'm writing, I have to put words on paper, I have to come up with a headline that has a benefit, and I have to open, maybe I should open with a shocking fact, and you've got all this in your head, right? And you lose touch with that part of yourself that I think Gary Halbert was in touch with when he was out on the boat talking to people about the product, which is just your natural persuasive ability. Mm-hmm. Like if you were trying to persuade Jonathan, you know, to buy this product that you're selling, right?
Right.
You can just talk to him about it and persuade him and say, look, and this and that and the other thing and all these people, and I know you love this and it's got this in it, right? But we start to write and we kind of use that part of our brain that used to write book reports in the sixth grade.
Yeah.
You know, you should read this book. It is very informative. You know, it's like.
Yeah. And my daughter would bring home work. My daughter's 20 now, so she's out of high school, but she would bring stuff, you know, assignments to me because I'm the writer in the family. Right. So, and then I would look at him like, this is all wrong. Like, you're never convince anybody with this essay.
Right.
She's like, but the rules that they had to go by, like third person and like, you can't have an opinion and like all this stuff was just, and I had forgotten that we've all been taught that same basic framework. So you got to unlearn all that before you can really start writing persuasively again. Cause it's just, it's so anti-persuasive.
The scary thing is when your kids, you know, like start to incorporate your tactics of persuasion in their writing. Like my daughter sent me something once and it was kind of like, it was very like, you know, there's like scarcity in it. Like, I don't know how much longer, and here's why you should do this for me because, you know, A, you love your daughter, and B, because of this, and, you know, C, because this, and there were just some, yeah, really deep benefits going on there. You know?
Yeah.
Like that. And I'm like, wow, how'd you do this? You go, Dad, I've been reading that stuff you write.
Oh, for
the past, you know.
Yeah. They mirror years. Your stuff.
Pick up a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
I'm convinced teenagers are some of the most persuasive, that's, I mean, they're the most persuasive of the, of their age bracket. I mean, they can convince you of anything. I think they're just kind of taking all of the stuff that you have put out and just kind of sending it right back to you.
They're great at feeding your lines back to you, that's for sure.
Because they record everything.
The one thing you didn't want them to hear, they hear, and they use it back against you, for
that's
sure.
That's right.
And your actions, too, damn it. Yeah. Like, it's, you can't just say you have to be a good person. You have to actually be a good person in life for your kids to emulate that. No.
Yeah, yeah. They, what's the old saying? People, it's not taught, it's caught.
Yeah.
Like most of what they learn, it's not. Yeah. So that's cool. So you got the headlines, you start doing a little research, you're talking to people.
Yeah. I don't know if I've got the headlines so much as the, how am I going to make this different? How am I going to make this persuasive? How am I going to make this the most important thing that's come across someone's desk or phone or whatever computer today? How am I going to make this, you know, just easy to grasp, you know, to seem as magic bullet as it can possibly be? Because let's face it, people just like us, right? Like, I'm not going to do something unless it's a magic bullet. I'm not going to buy a course unless I feel like, geez, if I just buy the course, I think I'm going to be a better copywriter. So I'm going to, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Like, we all want that.
Yeah. I was reading a sales letter today from Perry Marshall, for his highest end, kind of his personal client group, I think he calls it. Man, that is such a, I mean, the letter is just so good. I was reading it. I was just kind of poking around his site for some stuff. And next thing I know, I'd spent 20 minutes reading the sales letters. Like, I had other stuff to write and do. And it's like,
that's right.
And I was ready to sign up. Like, it's just, it's just, and he has that same kind of thing where he just really talks right to you and what you're going through, and it stands out. So what are you looking for? How do you, I guess, Dave, like, you made a good point about it's got to come, when people come across it, it's got to grab them. And I know we say that a lot in copy training. You hear that a lot. I'd love to hear your take on that. How important that is, and maybe give people a better understanding of how you see that, like where the prospect is and why it's so important. Give it a little more context, because I don't think people can get this enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, first, the prospect is not interested, right? Inherently in what you have, right? I mean, not that they're not interested. They're not focused, right?
Right.
They're scrolling. They're just sort of maybe some native ad or email led them to your VSL page or something. But they're still skeptical. They just want to make sure it's not for them so they can get off, right? They really don't want it to be something they want in a certain way, because that's going to mean spending time reading it, money. They just kind of want confirmation that this is not the magic bullet that I'm looking for. And so the first job is to really pull them into the page, right? Is to really just grab them in some way. So maybe that's some kind of a juxtaposition, something that's a little bit shocking, something that's unusual, right? How to lose money in the stock market versus how to make money in the stock market.
Right.
You know, why French women never get fat. wow, that's, you know, never thought about that. That's interesting. Yeah. So it's got to grab you like that. And then it's got to have some kind of something, some new way of looking at things, right? Some new mechanism for solving a problem. First, it's got to be a problem. It's got to solve a problem that I haven't care about. So either you've got to address a problem that I deeply care about, or make me care about a problem that I may not really care about, like, you know, whatever that is, right? The coming apocalypse, or, you know.
Right, on the more, unaware end of the awareness scale, you got to create all that.
My calcium levels, my, you know, whatever. Right.
Right.
I may not care about my calcium levels, but I do care about my bones breaking or winding up a cripple in my old age or something like that. So you've got to kind of connect things like that for people, and make sure the stakes are high. And, you know, you've got to, at the same time, you've got to be entertaining people. Mm-hmm. It's got to be interesting, right? Mm-hmm. You can't bore someone to death or they'll leave. And, you know, it doesn't mean like it's got to be a three-ring circus, right? You know, and dancing bears. But sometimes kind of it's got to be a lot of stuff going on and a lot of dopamine.
Especially today with people's attention span, right? I mean, you got to keep them entertained and glued to the page or they click elsewhere. They, you know, keep scrolling.
Yeah. And you know, I think there's – Orrin Claff talks about three things that people that people are attuned to change. Well, a lot of people probably talk about this, but this idea that, you know, from the savannah, we saw a movement and a bush moved and it was in a different place or something. And we're like, okay, that could be a lion. I got to be on alert. And we're still kind of alert for change, right? It's like scroll. Wait, it's a whole new ball game in investing. I guess I better look. Or something has changed, right? Something has changed in economically, sociologically, right? The millennials are buying houses and spending money, and that's going to make the stock market go up or whatever it is. So it's like why they should pay attention to this right now. So there's got to be that element in there too. It's like, why now? Why immediately? What's changed? What's the movement that I can make that's going to get their attention? You know, like you're kind of flagging somewhat like this kind of just movement.
Yep. Right? Yep.
Something has shifted. Something's different. If you do know about it, you're going to have that secret advantage that you're always longing to have. If you don't know about it, you're going to be sorry and, you know, lose money, lose health, lose whatever it is you're going to lose opportunity. Have FOMO in the morning when you see other people using it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about just movement and to think about that. Like if you know where your promotion is going to end up and trying to look at it, everything that's going on in that environment, whatever that is, you know, starting with the ad, working your way forward, you know, because it's easy to think, well, our stuff's good until you kind of see it in front of everything else, right? Mm-hmm. So if it's a stream of noise, then silence stands out, right? Anything contrast is going to stand out. And I think a lot of people think they have a cool idea or a big idea or something like that. And then, but when you throw it in the native environment where that ad's going to live, it just kind of blends right in and there's no movement. And, I think you have to keep that in mind and not be so much in isolation that you forget where this is going to end up.
Yeah. That's why it's a good idea sometimes. Take your ads, take your copy, put it side by side with a bunch of other stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that helps you also see if it pops out in some way, right? But it also helps you see that this copy over here does certain things in a better way. Right. Ooh, my ad seems black and white next to the copy in this ad. Why is that? Right. Mm-hmm. So you look and you analyze. I mean, I think that's really the only difference between really good writers and mediocre writers. Right. I mean, we're just, you know, really good writers are like relentless about comparing their copy, looking at copy. They're really relentless about some of the things we just talked about. Like, I've got to persuade this person on so many levels. I've got to make it interesting and wave my hands. I've got to let him know that there's change he's got to care about. I've got to entertain him. I've got to do everything I can to keep him on the page. Where I think a lot of writers, especially when they're starting out, they're just concerned with getting words on the page. I've got to write 3,000, you know, 18,000 or however many words of copy, and here we go. Okay, right? Yeah. And, you know, it's just because it's true. It's a lot, right? Some of the long copy that we do.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot just to get the words on the page.
Absolutely. My head's going in a bunch of different directions. Jonathan, you have a anything you want to ask? If not, I'll break. I got to go ahead.
Yeah, so I was looking at earlier, before you came on, I was reading some of your blog posts. By the way, I love some of your blog titles. Your headlines are really good.
Imagine that.
Yeah. So talk about, you mentioned you've got one that says stop writing, start talking. I think that's great advice for any copywriter, like going back instead of, you know, just reading your stuff actually, or reading it silently, just reading it out loud, because, and see how it sounds. I mean, would I talk like this? Would I talk like the way I write? And that's really basically what you're trying to do is write like you would be having a conversation with somebody. And if you're reading that copy back and it really doesn't sound, it doesn't sound like you're having a conversation with the reader, then I think you got problems there. But that's, I think, yeah, that's probably a mistake a lot of people make.
Yeah. I mean, I try to put myself out of a job by getting people to actually read their own copy out loud.
Yeah.
And talk to people, right? Because half of what I do, they could find out by just talking to people.
Yeah.
And then they, when I look at it, we could talk about more strategic things and how to elevate it even to the next level. But so many people don't show their copy to anyone, don't read it out loud, don't, you know, the talking thing, right? That's what Gary was doing when he was on his boat. He wasn't just, you know, fishing. He was talking to people about the product.
Yeah.
While he was doing that, he was working it out with them and getting feedback and bored looks or excited looks. He was market testing it.
Absolutely. And you know, and it makes sense, right? Because, I mean, Jonathan and I have both been in sales, you know, through, Jonathan is still in sales. I've been in sales throughout my life. You know, copy is salesmanship in print. Yep. One of the things you get to do in sales is you get immediate feedback on your presentation. Right. Copy you don't. So you got to go create that as you're writing and have those conversations with people or in forums or wherever you can to try to get both sides of the thing. Because, you know, any salesperson will tell you, you can go in with a pitch, but it's kind of like boxing. Like, you know, you got a pitch plan, but until you get in there and somebody hits you with a certain objection or a certain look, or they kind of roll their eyes to their spouse or their, you know, the guy next to them in the boardroom, it's a different game all of a sudden at that point, because they're obviously not tracking with you. And as a copywriter, you have to anticipate that. And the only way to do that is to do your research.
Yeah. And how great is it when you anticipate what people's objections and where they're going to start to get skeptical or what they're going to be skeptical about? Because you might not even know. You might assume that you've made a statement and it's believable, right? Mm-hmm. Some statement in your chain of logic. But if they don't believe this statement in your chain of logic, then everything underneath it that you concluded because of that is not going to be believed. So if you're talking to someone and this is, you know, they question it, you're going to know to write the copy. You better have a whole bunch of proof elements at that point. I mean, it doesn't hurt to prove everything you say and have proof elements for it. But
yeah, I agree. That's a good point. Like, if any link in your chain of logic is weak, then breaks the whole chain.
Yeah. I mean, I try to get people to even think in terms of chains of logic.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, is like, how would you describe that to somebody who doesn't know what we're talking about?
Well, chain of logic is just kind of if A, then B, if B, then C, right? You know, if gold is a metal, and, you know, and metals, you know, I don't know, are shiny, then this is shiny, so it must be a metal. I mean, that's probably a syllogism rather than a logic chain. But, you know, it's kind of like gold. Clayton used to give a great example. Gold is going to go up. When gold goes up, gold stocks go up more than gold because they're leveraged, right? They use gold. Therefore, you know, since gold is going to go up, you should therefore buy gold stocks right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've just got to prove everything along the way, right? You've got to prove gold is going to go up. You've got to you know, this look, it's going to go up. It's this is happening. India is buying gold. There's a shortage of this. It's needed for this. Then you've got to prove that gold stocks go up greater than gold, right? So it's like, look at this historically. And they, you could see from these charts and logically, because it's, you know, because it's leveraged, right? Obviously, the companies that dig for gold are going to go up more because they're capable of producing so much gold. So they're going to go up like 10 to 1. And then when you say, therefore, you should buy gold stocks, people will listen to you.
Right.
And they will feel that, the logic of that. But I think a lot of times people write stuff and they're kind of building chains of logic, but they're not really aware they're doing that. And their stuff isn't really connected to each other in the same way that that example was.
Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, it's more like,
I don't know that just because of this, that this would necessarily, like if you really look at it, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that just because that's true, that that means this is true, right?
Yeah, it's more like a chain of claims. Mm-hmm. You know, people, I see that a lot in the copy that I see from some other people is they make a lot of claims, but then there's no proof that really builds the logic part of it. Like they get really into the emotional claims or the promises or things like that, but then they don't go through and back those up. Yeah. Do you find that you do those, that you kind of get the claims, you have to go back and fill in the proof, or do you kind of take each part one at a time as you're writing?
A little bit of both. I try to prove as much as I can where I'm going as I'm doing it, but then sometimes I'll go back and go, okay, this needs a little more, you know, boosting. Let me see if I can find a study or, you know, I mean, there's so many different kinds of proof that people don't utilize, right? There's, I mean, we all know kind of the basic proofs, right? Track record, study, you know, media mentions, things
social
like that.
Social proof, testimonials.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's a lot of other kinds of proof, you know, there's even a common sense kind of proof, right? It's kind of like, you know, you need this herb because just like your body needs oil, like your car needs oil, your body needs, you know, this herb, which kind of makes your joints more lubricated, right? Because joints don't get arthritis.
Yeah. I think, one of my books, I think it was in Architecture Persuasion that Mark Ford wrote. He talks about the six or seven different types of proof. And I think one of them was a metaphor, you know, metaphor, simile type of proof. I love those. Those to me are fun to write.
Yeah. One of my favorite is that thing of, you know, if phone lines are busy, please keep trying. You know, that's like a kind of implied truth proof there. It's a lot of people are calling. It must be good. So therefore, you know.
Yeah, and for those that aren't familiar with the reference, so that's when, I guess what?
Like an
infomercials. Infomercials were like, operators are standing by, and they switched that phrase from operators are standing by, which is this visually, if you think about like Schwartz, when his book, the writing book, not Breakthrough Advertising, but the other one. The Brilliance Breakthrough. He's like, what's the image going on in people's mind if operators are standing by? It's like, they're waiting. Phones aren't ringing.
Got nothing else to do.
That's right.
Your call.
Yeah, they're just sitting there.
It's kind of like the empty restaurant. You know, it's like if you drive by a restaurant and there's no crowds, like you don't really want to go. You don't want too much of a crowd because you want to be able to get in. But there's definitely that line that it needs a little life.
Yeah,
for people to buy into it.
Right.
Creating a little bit of scarcity there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great example because I don't think a lot of people would see that as proof, but it really is a type of proof that this is what we say it is, because obviously people are calling and you may have to call twice. Not that anybody knows what a busy signal is anymore, but.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a type of proof or type of thing in argumentation called a warrant, which I've always found very interesting, which is kind of why does this prove that? In other words, sometimes it's not that, like you could say, a study found this, right? Or you could say that someone says this. But why does someone saying that, you know, what prestige does he have? What qualifications does he have? What other things has he said were true that turned out to be really true? You know, why this particular study? Well, because it was done with a lot. So there's a lot to, you know, sometimes people try to disprove something, right? They say, well, that can't be possible because blah, 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 right? You go, well, I don't know if that applies exactly, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not only piling up proof, but it's also just helping people grasp that that it is true, that it that, and not that it is true, that that proof is relevant.
Yes, relevance. It's a great word for it. It's like, because it's one thing to pull a third party quote, which, you know, is taught a lot, right? Use a third party quote to make a point. But if, like you said, if you can't give credentials for that quote, or you could make it stronger, like you said, with the study, like it's a double blind placebo, you know, board certified, whatever type I'm study. Yeah. Which is like in the only 0.1% of all studies get this mark of approval. Now that study goes from being a study to being like almost irrefutable.
Yeah.
It's a huge difference in believability.
And it's a real thing too. I mean, you know, most one-off studies are not terribly definitive. Right. You know, you could do a study and say this drinking LaCroix, you know, makes you healthier. Someone else could do a study and show that drinking LaCroix doesn't make you healthy.
Yeah.
So really what you want is a mega study, which studies all the studies that have been done, right? And says, wow, there's like 20 of them say it makes you healthy. 10 of them say, you know, didn't find anything. So I guess it does. Or they find that if you put all the studies together, there is no definitive, you know, health benefit from drinking LaCroix.
Yeah. And this goes back to research where, you know, as a copywriter, you have to notice those types of things that a lot of people would read right past.
Mm-hmm.
When you find a study, to know if it's peer reviewed or not, to know if it's a mega study or just a one-off study, or, you know,
yeah,
or all those different things, they seem just like kind of words in front of the study, but if you know how to use them, it's like a good tool, right? If you know how to use the tool, you can do a lot cooler things than somebody who doesn't know how to use the tool.
Well, so that's where depth comes in. You know, a lot of copywriters could benefit, I think. People try to be better writers, but I think it's much easier to be better at a lot of the other things that go into writing than actually writing. The writing in a way doesn't matter that much. Right, you don't have to be a really good writer to be a great copywriter.
Yeah.
And some of the best copywriters I know aren't particularly great writers. You know what I mean? They're not really clever. It's not clever. It's not, you know, got all this stuff in it. But boy, they're such good salespeople, and they're such good copywriters, and they say exactly what needs to be said to get someone to buy in exactly the right way, at exactly the right time, that it just takes your breath away, right? How well they do that.
What would you say some of those other things are besides writing? I mean, we've talked about research. You say the other things.
There's a kind of, I think it's getting on a deeper level of human persuasion and emotion, right? Like Dan Kennedy, mm-hmm. you know, talks a lot about all the different, you know, the seven deadly sins kind of thing, right? It's not just greed or fear, but there's also jealousy. There's also shame. There's also, you know, ease, right? Which is kind of like gluttony or something. Well, ease, you know, people are inherently lazy. Even, you know, even kind of, you know, relationship type stuff, right? That doing certain things It's like making more money in the stock market, right? You could just talk about how it's going to get your Mercedes. You could talk about how it's, you know, you're going to make all this money, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, the best writers take it more deeply than that in terms of what it means to be successful to you as a person, to becoming the provider for your family that you want to be.
Right? Yeah, that's Clayton talked a lot about that with the dominant resident emotion and the going two or three or four or five layers deep on the emotion and what that means and what that means and what that means.
Right.
And yeah, it's such a simple exercise to do. And I think so few people do it. Mm-hmm. They really try to get back to that dominant emotion. Like I've noticed in the last 5-6 years, I feel like everything is about people wanting to feel safe. It's like, if you kept going back and asking the question, why, it's like people want to feel safe in their marriage, safe in their relationship, safe at their job, yeah. Safe at, you know, not losing their kids to whatever. Like it seems to more and more go all back to safety. Like, do people feel safe?
Well, certainly in a Maslow kind of hierarchy, yeah. I think that's down at the bottom.
Yeah.
The foundational thing of, if you're not safe, you're not going to go looking for food, and you're not going to go looking for spiritual fulfillment.
Right.
You're going to try to kill that lion that's, you know, stalking you.
Yeah. So in this world of like chaos, got to make them feel safe first, and then we can ascend them up Maslow's hierarchy of needs and get really aspirational with them and all that kind of stuff. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a fine line, because sometimes you want to shake that safety, depending on what you're selling and how you're selling it, right? You want to make it feel not safe, and the product provides the safety. So,
I picture the Bill Bonner ad where he talked about, you know, the international living that we've talked about in past shows, Sean, mm-hmm. where he talks about, you know, you're sitting in a hammock on your back porch, you're watching the gardener, and it's like, you're already thinking past the sale, because you're like, whoa, I got a gardener? That's awesome. I mean, it's like, I can picture that. I can picture seeing a gardener, but yeah, there's some safety. I mean, ultimately you're thinking comfort, safety, and the story that tells puts you right there in it.